swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Ratner.
Doctor, can you give us your name and address for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Jean-Ronel Corbier, and my address is 990 Leanne Drive, Concord, North Carolina.
Could you spell your name for the court reporter, please?
J-E-A-N-R-O-N-E-L. Last name is Corbier, C-O-R-B-I-E-R.
What's your profession?
I am a board-certified child neurologist.
Would you describe the nature of your current practice?
Yes, I practice in Concord. I take care of children with neurological disorders, all types of neurological ailments, including autism. I work full-time as a clinical neurologist.
Are you board certified in any area?
Yes, I am board certified in neurology with special qualification in child neurology.
In your current practice, do you treat children with autism?
Yes, I treat many children with autism and have done so for the past several years.
Are you Yates Hazelhurst neurologist?
Yes, I am currently Yates Hazelhurst neurologist.
When did you first see Yates?
I believe the first visit was back in September of 2002. He had recently been diagnosed.
I filed a current copy of your CV as Exhibit 36. Does that CV accurately describe your education and work experience?
Yes, that should be an updated copy of my CV.
Doctor, what is autism?
Autism is a neurodevelopmental condition that presents with three core areas of deficits. One is problems with communication and language. Children with autism are unable to express their needs. The second area is that of social interaction. Children with autism have impaired social interaction. And then the third area is behavioral. They have very restricted interests. They tend to have self-stimulatory behaviors such as hand flapping. And these three core areas constitute what we label as autism.
When do children usually suffer the first symptoms of autism?
That is highly variable. Some children may show manifestations very early on, a year, sometimes even less, although the signs before a year could be quite subtle. Some can start showing signs at 15 months, 18 months, 2 years, and there have been even case reports of individuals after three, which is unusual, showing signs. So it's really very variable.
In your opinion, do the differences in the timing of the onset of symptoms mean that there are important differences between the autism of those who never developed correctly, those who regress, and those who regress later in life?
Yes, I think the timing is important and underlines the point that autism is not really one disorder. There are a lot of different subtypes. For instance, there's some children that start showing signs very early on. There are other children that appear quite normal. I think Yates would be a good example of that. And then later they regress, what we call regressive autism. And so we're dealing with, even though we're dealing with a condition that behaviorally is labeled as autism, there are a lot of underlying etiologies with different times of onset and different implications therefore.
Is the prognosis, or say the likely outcome of autism, different in children whose symptoms began at different times?
It's highly variable there again, because there's some children that start with early signs that may do well, although in my experience, some children that have problems from the very beginning may go on to have severe symptoms, but the reverse may also be true. You may have someone with regressive autism that does well, or you may have a person with regressive autism that may go on to have chronic problems. So here again, it's very variable.
In your opinion, do the differences in timing of the onset of symptoms suggest that there are differences in what causes autism with the onset, the early onset, and those who suffer a regressive autism?
Yes, if someone starts manifesting symptoms very early, for instance, in early infancy, someone who presents maybe not just with core autistic symptoms, but let's say seizures or other problems, I would be more likely to think of an antenatal etiology or genetic or metabolic versus someone who is perfectly normal until later on. I would think that other factors, including environmental factors, may have a greater role in these individuals. So I think the timing can help us sort out the different etiologic factors that are present, as we know that there are various factors that play a role in different cases of autism.
What causes a child to develop regressive autism?
The belief is that with regressive autism, that first of all, the child must have an underlying genetic tendency. We think that genes play an important role in most kids with autism. But because they are normal and doing well, we feel that environmental factors also play a role. And so in regressive autism, it's very likely that we're dealing both with genetic influences and external environmental factors.
Is it widely accepted that environmental factors are a substantial contributing cause to most cases of regressive autism?
I think if you read the literature and what has been written, many articles point to a multifactorial etiology, including environmental factors. For example, Martha Herbert, who's a child neurologist at Harvard, and various others point to environmental factors as playing a role. We don't, at this point, know all of the environmental factors that play a role, but there's a general understanding that environmental factors contribute to the development of autism.
In your opinion, is MMR vaccination an environmental factor that can cause a genetically susceptible child to develop regressive autism?
Based on studies that have looked at children with regressive autism, I think MMR has been implicated in a subset of children. It's very important for me to mention subset. I don't think that one can generally say MMR causes autism in general, but if you look at a very specific subset of children with regressive autism that regress after the vaccine has been given and who have a particular clinical profile with gastrointestinal problems, several studies strongly suggest that that is one environmental causative factor.
Could you describe for us the clinical profile that implicates the vaccine?
Typical clinical profile would be a child who is developing normally, doing well, is vaccinated, and subsequently starts having problems. Autistic symptomatology, loss of interest, the child becomes withdrawn. But in addition, the child also has significant gastrointestinal manifestations, diarrhea, bloating, malabsorption, so-called leaky gut. Sometimes the diarrhea may alternate with constipation. So a lot of gastrointestinal issues. On top of that, the child may have evidence of immunological problems, a child that is sickly. So that profile is highly suggestive of MMR being implicated in regressive autism in that setting.
Why would combination of autism and gastrointestinal symptoms suggest a relationship between the vaccination, or between the MMR vaccination and the autism?
Can you repeat that again?
Why would the combination, if you will, of regressive autism, and, which begins after vaccination, and specifically gastrointestinal symptoms, why would that implicate the vaccine?
Okay, that's a good question. Before we even look at vaccines, to answer your question, we have to ask, can the measles virus or other viral infections for that matter, can they cause regression, can they cause neurobehavioral, neurologic, and gastrointestinal problems? Several studies have implicated the measles virus itself as a contributing factor to both gastrointestinal problems and neurological problems, including autism and developmental delay. But we can go a step beyond that, and if you see a group of children with autism and gastrointestinal problem, you can look at their gut and try to isolate a measles virus, which has been done by Ullman, who actually looked at a group of developmentally delayed children with gastrointestinal problems. But others have taken it a little bit further. For example, Dr. Kawashima has found that the persistence of measles virus in the gut of individuals with autism, he was able to tell that that strain was not a wild strain, but it was actually a vaccine strain. I think another good study was by, I believe it was Pittenham, who actually found there was a case of a child who was vaccinated at 12 months with the MMR, did well, and then 8.5 months later, that child developed seizures, started to regress, had a lot of problems. Unfortunately, that child eventually died, but in the process, a brain biopsy was done, and it was very revealing that it was found that that child had persistence of measles virus in the brain, and then when they tried to see exactly what type of strain this was, it was a vaccine strain. And so I think there's ample evidence in the literature to suggest that the MMR is associated with persistence of measles virus in the gut and also in the brain. Bradstreet and others have shown that the cerebral spinal fluid of children, of certain children that were looked at with autism, had the measles virus. We also know that the measles virus is very virulent and very immunosuppressive, so it would make a lot of sense based on a biological framework to suggest what I'm saying.
Now, this child that you described, that they did the autopsy and found presence of measles in the brain, did that child have autism?
The child had autistic symptoms, but he actually developed a lot. He developed a lot of other symptoms, seizures. He later became comatose. And so he was diagnosed with inclusion body encephalitis.
Does the measles virus cause a variety of different central nervous system illnesses?
Yes, I think what is very interesting with the measles virus is that we have in front of us a natural history in the environment of what happens with when someone gets infected with the measles. Although most individuals in the past who were infected with the measles virus developed symptoms and that were temporary and then resolved, there's a group of individuals that developed acute encephalitis. That is, after they were injected with the, or after they received the illness, they then developed encephalitis, neurological problems, seizures, confusion. But then there's another group that did not show any manifestations after they were infected with the measles virus until later, until anywhere from 1 to 9 months later. These people developed a type of encephalitis we call subacute encephalitis or inclusion body encephalitis. And that's very interesting because, frankly, the majority of individuals in the past who had the measles infection did well, recovered, but there was a subset that went on to have post-infectious encephalitis. In fact, in the group of those who had the inclusion body encephalitis, there's a subset of them that had clear evidence of immunosuppression. And then there's a third group that after they were infected with the measles virus did well, not for a week or two, a month or two, but several years, and then developed an acute encephalitis. And most neurologists in this country, and especially child neurologists, know this entity as SSPE, subacute sclerosing panencephalitis. So it's a condition that is preceded years in advance by measles, and then something happens which causes that individual, due to persistence of the measles, which may be transformed in the brain, to then develop a very serious condition that we call SSPE. So I think if we look at these models that are right there in nature, you have an illness where you have a virus that can cause different types of post-infectious problems. We have a perfect model for looking at measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines, which are in fact live attenuated vaccines. Now the question is, if I may elaborate a little bit, can the MMR vaccine cause measles or infection? Well, we can also look at other vaccines that have been used in the United States to answer that question, such as oral polio. Oral polio was discontinued in the U.S. because there were several cases of individuals that were vaccinated with the oral polio vaccine to try to prevent the illness when they were, you know, not necessarily very likely to get the illness, but then they came down with polio. So the decision was made several years ago to not give oral polio, but instead to do give an inactivated form of polio, which I applaud that decision. I think it's a lot safer. Well, with measles, with MMR, it's very likely, and there are a lot of evidence and reports in the medical literature of individuals persisting with the measles virus, both in the gut and the brain. And perhaps later we'll talk about brain-gut connections. So to answer your question.
Do we know why some individuals develop SSPE years after their exposure to the measles virus?
I think the best explanation, although there are things that we still have to learn, is that everyone's different. Perhaps people have different genetic makeups, and that's one reason I think genes are so important, such that some people may develop an infection early, others later on, and others, most people, not at all. And I think the same thing applies with MMR. I think most people that are vaccinated with MMR have absolutely no problems. I received my MMR vaccine a few weeks ago for my booster because I didn't suspect that I would have problems. I have not in the past. But that does not mean that everyone has the same immunological makeup as I do. There are individuals that have a particular makeup that make them vulnerable. So I think genes play a role, the person's constitutional makeup, that would determine if someone tolerates it well, and in most cases people do, versus those that have problems down the road.
Excuse me. Is there, you've described at least three different kinds of central nervous system illnesses caused by measles vaccine, measles virus. The acute measles encephalitis, subacute measles, with measles inclusion body encephalitis, and SSPE.
Yes.
Is there any reason to believe that that's the whole universe of central nervous system diseases caused by the measles virus?
Well, I think these are the three entities that have been best described, but it's likely that there's a whole shade in between. In other words, you may have individuals who may have something that's a cross between acute encephalitis and the typical subacute encephalitis or inclusion body, or you may have someone that has a clinical profile that's not quite similar to that of SSP. So I think it's very reasonable that there's a whole spectrum of problems. And those three just represent what's been studied and identified, the prototypical cases, if you will.
Turning back to the significance of evidence of measles virus persisting in the intestines, in your report, you cite a report by Petitioner's Exhibit 37E, Uhlman,
yes,
Potential Viral Pathologic Mechanisms for New Variant Inflammatory Bowel Disease. And you cite that for the proposition that measles virus is found in the gut of children with autism. Do you feel that the Uhlman findings are reliable?
I believe that Uhlman's findings are reliable based on the fact that he used a lot of controls and up-to-date techniques to try to verify the persistence of measles virus in the group of children that he studied, namely children with developmental delays. And so, to answer your question very briefly, yes, I think that was a well-done, valid study.
Have other people duplicated any part of that study?
Yes, I think there are several labs that have tried to look at Uhlman's study, and I think some labs used techniques that were a little bit different. For example, I believe that Uhlman looked at the gut tissue. There are other labs that looked at the blood to try to see if they could replicate the virus. Some of those labs, not surprisingly, came up with different findings. In fact, one of the labs did not even evaluate children who actually had gastrointestinal problems. But I think Dr. Stephen Walker's lab has done a better job at replicating the findings than other molecular biologists, Dr. Hebner and others. So I think that that study has been, or that finding has been replicated and validates the findings of Dr. Ullman and others.
And Dr. Stephen Walker, is that the report that Dr. Hebner testified about in the CDO case?
Yes, I believe that that is the one.
Can does the measles virus need to be present in the brains of children for it to cause central nervous system injuries?
Yes and no. Let me explain. Various viruses, and not just the measles virus, someone can be infected with the virus. They may get rid of the infection, but then subsequently the immune system may overreact and create what we call an autoimmune disorder. When that occurs, the antibodies may travel everywhere, including the brain, and cause problems. So that would be one case scenario where a virus, including the measles, without attacking brain cells, may result in a neurological problem. But of course, in many other cases, as has been shown by brain biopsies, and cerebral spinal fluid, which is a better way to assess what's going on in the nervous system, have shown the persistence of measles virus in the brain, which more directly implicates the virus as causing neuronal damage. The measles virus can cause a variety of changes, toxic changes, that can damage neurons. So that mechanism also exists.
Can autoimmune responses in the gut cause central nervous system injuries?
Yes, I think there are several good examples of that. I think it was Mavrudi who did a nice article on celiac disease. Celiac disease traditionally has been considered a gastrointestinal problem. Celiac disease is a condition where some individuals do not tolerate gluten. Gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, rye. And when individuals that have celiac disease partake of gluten products or wheat, the immune system elicits a very abnormal reaction where it attacks the gut. And the resulting problem can include chronic diarrhea in small children, weight loss, malabsorption, just a lot of symptoms. Well, Mavrudi showed that in addition to gastrointestinal problems, some individuals have brain-related defect. There's Mavrudi, there's Gooden, and several authors that have shown anything ranging from cerebellar ataxia, where the immune cells attack the cerebellum, which controls balance in individuals with celiac disease. Goodwin has shown that you can develop strokes from celiac disease. So there's a whole range of seizures. Actually, I think Mavrudi or Mackin talked about epilepsy. There was a case reported in one of our journals, the Pediatric Neurology Journal, where an individual presented primarily with seizures, refractory epilepsy, and they happened to be doing a study, and that individual was diagnosed with celiac disease. So I think there's clear evidence. There's celiac disease, there's inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis that are well known to cause extra intestinal problems, including neurological problems. So I think it's very clear, undisputed, that many immunological problems that affect the gut also affect the brain. And no one can deny the brain-gut axis.
Yeah, did some of those studies actually look at the antibodies doing the damage in the gut and the brain?
Yes. Some of these studies have found that the antibodies had receptors not only to the gut, but also to the brain. And this is something that we're finding with a variety of chemicals, even secretin, that has been looked at in autism. There are receptors for secretin in the gut, but there are also receptors in the brain. That should not be too surprising because we have millions and millions of nerve cells in the gut. I like to think of the gut sometimes as a secondary brain. So there are a lot of neurological cells in the gut, and so again, that supports the relationship of the gut and brain.
Now, when someone suffers central nervous system symptoms of celiac disease, like, say, ataxia or seizures, is the celiac disease, the intestinal aspect of the celiac disease, always apparent when the person suffers the central nervous system illness?
Not necessarily. There have been several cases, for example, in gluten ataxia, so-called gluten ataxia. Someone may present with unsteady gait, that's what the term ataxia means, and the gastrointestinal symptoms may be very mild. In the other case I talked about with celiac disease and refractory seizure, here was a child who presented with hard-to-control seizures, and it's not until it was recognized that the child had celiac disease, had these antibodies directed to the gut, but presumably to the brain, only then was that child taken off of gluten, placed on a gluten-free diet, and guess what happened to the seizures? The seizures got better. The child was on anti-epileptic medications as well, but the point is that child was refractory to treatment with the medication until an autoimmune process such as celiac was discovered, gluten was removed, the seizures stopped.
In your opinion, is exposure to thimerosal, or as a result of vaccination, an environmental factor that can cause a genetically susceptible child to develop autism?
My answer to that is yes. I believe that thimerosal is among the environmental factors that are implicated in autism and related problems. And I base that statement on the fact that first we have to understand what thimerosal is. Thimerosal is a preservative that has been very poorly studied in the 1930s. I think there was one case where they looked at toxicity in an individual just for one day and concluded that it was safe. But thimerosal is 50% ethyl mercury. Ethyl mercury is a type of organic mercury. There are different types of mercuries. There's elemental mercury, there's inorganic and organic. Well, ethyl mercury has been found to be neurotoxic, highly neurotoxic, like other organic mercury, such as methyl mercury, which has been studied in various populations. But the question is, it's one thing to say that thimerosal is neurotoxic, it's yet another thing to say that it's implicated in conditions such as autism or developmental problems for that matter. There have been several studies, first that confirmed that thimerosal was toxic. There have been some outbreaks in Japan, so-called Minamata disease, and Iraq, which led the United States to do further studies and look at certain islands, such as the Faroe Islands and the Seychelles, where they were noticing that a lot of children had neurodevelopmental problems that were unexplained, while further studies showed that they were exposed to methylmercury. The parents were, the mothers were, and it affected the children much more than they did the parent, which the parents, which led researchers to note that the developing brain is very susceptible to methylmercury. Some studies have looked at methylmercury and compared methylmercury with ethylmercury, and more and more studies are being done, and there is good evidence to suggest that ethylmercury, although it's a different organic mercury, is also very toxic. In fact, if or when ethylmercury reaches the brain, it converts to inorganic mercury 7 times faster than methylmercury. There are further studies that have been done to answer the question of exposure. After all, many children are vaccinated. Not everyone comes down with autism or neurodevelopmental problems. So I don't think it's necessarily an exposure per se, but studies show that it's a problem with excretion. Many children with autism do not excrete do not excrete mercury very well. Amy Holmes, in a very recent study done, looked at mercury in the teeth and confirmed that children with autism, many of them have a much higher burden of mercury than children who do not have autism. So really all of these factors strongly point to the fact that in some individuals, particularly those that are genetically susceptible, can, as a result of thimerosal, develop autism, perhaps along with a few other factors.
Do you believe that participants in Exhibit 48, Thompson et al., early thimerosal exposure and neuropsychological outcomes at 7 and 10, and that was published September 27th in the New England, 2007, in the New England Journal of Medicine. Do you think that the results of that study hurts your case for thimerosal causing neurologic injury?
I actually think that this case helps to support that thimerosal can cause a neurologic injury. I don't think that study focused on autism, but what interesting finding is that children were noticed to have increased tics, both motor tics and a type of tic where sound is produced that we call vocal or phonic tics. Many children, in fact, with autism, or a subset of children with autism, have tic disorders. That's a well-established fact. So that leads me to believe that thimerosal can cause other neurological problems as well, such as tic disorders. I might add, I had one child that I saw several years ago who was vaccinated and a day or two started having tics. And that child had multiple tics, started having, he was not diagnosed with autism, but he had behavioral problems. And that child did well after mercury was removed from his system, the tic stopped right away. So I think thimerosal is neurotoxic in many ways, and of course can affect other organs as well, including or other organ systems like the immune system.
Doctor, does Yates Hazelhurst suffer regressive autism?
Yes, I was here yesterday and I heard the excellent testimony of several family members. And to me, it was very clear that autism, or that Yates was developing very normally up until about the first year of life. And from what I saw and heard, we were able to look at some videos, he did regress afterward. I was very interested to hear various perspectives from family members, parents, grandparents, and I don't think there could be a better description of regressive autism. So Yates does have regressive autism.
When, in your opinion, did Yates suffer the first symptom of autism?
From what I heard in the testimony yesterday, and I'm very glad that I was able to listen to the testimony because it gave me even bigger insight than I had when I first saw Yates and in the several years that I followed Yates. But what I heard fairly consistently is maybe a couple of months or so after his 12 years vaccines, he started showing signs of what several family members have referred to as running wild. He was wild, which means that he was very hyperactive. He had a tendency to wander. He had a tendency to, he was just a different child. As one family member, he was not as much a joy to be around as he had been before. So I would, and then he started having other symptoms as well, loss of interest with others, a decreased social interaction. He started becoming a picky eater. There were so many changes that were noted, but from what I heard, I would say probably about a couple of months or so after his 12 months vaccine. So by, let's say, April, March, in that time frame, as best as I could gather.
Could you tell us which of those things that were described yesterday by the family members you think are aspects of his autism?
I think, first of all, autism is best viewed as a collection of symptoms or signs. There are a lot of different things that fall into the spectrum of autism. So the first thing that I saw in Yates' case that suggested to me a change pertaining to his autism was his activity level, going from a fairly normal child going from an active child to a hyperactive child who is described as very wild. So I would say that that would be the first autistic symptom, listening to the testimonies that I could pinpoint.
How about the description that we heard that he lost interest in playing with his cousins, for example? Was that a symptom of his autism?
Yes, most certainly. In fact, loss of interest with individuals, your surrounding, would be one of the core features of autism. So initially, he played very well with his cousins. Again, we saw videos of him interacting with his two older cousins. They were happy. He appeared happy. But then that changed to a point where the cousins did not want to interact with him as much. Even the young cousins had noticed a difference. I think if young children can see a change, it must be pretty obvious.
There's a description of him losing interest in toys or not playing with them in the way he had before. Was that a feature of his autism?
Yes. Children with autism view the world, view the universe in a completely different manner than individuals that do not have autism. It's not that children with autism do not play with toys, but they do not play with toys in an appropriate manner, and the toys or the objects that they use is very restricted. I think it was a very nice scene where Yates was playing with a bowl, a glass bowl. He took the bowl, he turned it around, and he started to roll it. In fact, rolling that bowl was a very typical type of activity that a child with autism might engage in sometimes for prolonged periods of time.
Is that the scene from Amsterdam where he's in a diaper?
He was in a diaper. I can't remember if it was in Amsterdam, but I think he took a bowl from the table, he put it down, and he started to, yeah, I think he was in a diaper. He was rolling the bowl back and forth. He put it sideways and started to roll. Likewise, a child with autism who had a car, for example, instead of playing with the car in an appropriate manner, might flip the car or truck upside down and spin the wheels. That's a very typical autistic behavior.
So his aunt, I think, described that his favorite activity in late summer would be to turn over, I think it was a stroller, and spin wheels. Was that a feature of his autism?
Yes, that's another typical spinning wheels, stacking up objects, lining up objects. That gives you a sense of stereotypic, repetitive behavior, which tends to fascinate children with autism.
You mentioned a moment ago that he became a picky eater. Do you see that as a feature of his autism?
We see a fairly good subset of children with autism that become very picky eater, even if they were eating very well prior to that. Now, let me say that non-autistic children can also become picky eaters temporarily or to a certain extent. But children with autism, especially those that fall under those that have gastrointestinal problems, immunological problems, can become very picky. And I think Mrs. Hazelhurst gave a good description of some of the physical features of Yates after a period of time. He was not eating, and it showed. He had a protuberant belly, which most people would think of a malabsorption type of problem. So we're dealing with very significant picky eating, which we know can be caused by a lot of problems, not only neurological impairment. By the way, mercury, one of the things mercury can do, mercury toxicity, is to cause anorexia. But beyond that, there are gastrointestinal problems, reflux, esophagitis. Yates was later diagnosed with inflammation of the gut, of the colon, due to biopsy. So all of these things can combine to cause picky eating. There are also sensory problems. Kids with autism sometimes have what we call oral defensiveness. So the mere fact of putting food in their mouth could be something that's very hard for them to tolerate. So all of these explain why children with autism are picky eaters.
The parents described a change in the way Yates used language from bye and please and thank you to basically numbers and letters. Is that a feature of his autism?
Yeah. Yes. If you look at all of the changes, all of the linguistic regression that Yates underwent, we see that there are several patterns. One is he had loss of some of the words that he had mastered before. He also had loss of what I would call pragmatic language. It's one thing to say words. We see kids sometimes that may have a huge vocabulary, but they don't use it in a meaningful way, in a conversational manner. Yates had reached a point where he couldn't express his needs. So I think there are various ways in which Yates' speech and language were impaired and altered.
In the video, we saw a very brief scene where Yates was getting off the bus, and there's a brief scene where he might have been flapping his hands. I guess I'm asking, is that, in your opinion, hand flapping, is that autistic characteristic?
Yes, one of the common findings or signs in autism is what we call self-stimulatory behaviors. Self-stimulatory behaviors are behaviors that are partially or mostly involuntary, where some behaviors repeated over and over. A self-stimulatory behavior could be motor, so hand flapping would be a good example, actually a very common example that we see in children with autism. You can have visual stimming. Visual stimming is where you tilt your head a certain way just to kind of see things in a particular way that is soothing and pleasing to your visual field. Or in other words, your visual field allows you to perceive things in a way that soothes your brain. So instead of verbal motor stimming, you can turn your head a certain way. Some kids will just kind of line an edge and see things. Or I think a perfect description was given of Yates looking at the video or TV, looking at credits and things rolling, scrolling up and down. That was a form of visual stimulation. So yes, the hand flapping is definitely a form of self-stimulation.
If I might, yesterday at the end of the proceedings, the respondent inquired into Dr. Corbier's most recent records of Yates' most recent visit to Dr. Corbier. And I have provided a copy to the respondent, and I will file it, but I thought I would like to hand you a copy as well.
Please.
Because I'm going to ask a couple questions about it. I have multiple copies. I made five. So if you know, need a couple, would you guys like another one? So more than one person can look at it once? We could either identify it as a trial exhibit, or I could simply file it subsequently, whichever. I know in Sedillo, lots of people identify as trial exhibit. I haven't even thought through which is the best approach to take.
Let's do this. Let's start our trial exhibit list, although I think an ordinary exhibit would be exhibit 58, but let's start with this Marcus trial exhibit.
The petitioner's trial exhibit one?
Right.
Okay. You know, the first question I'm going to ask you about this is under developmental history. Is the history you provide there in your record inconsistent with your testimony you've given today about when Yates' regression began and occurred?
Yes, that's a good question. The let me read it. It says he developed normally until the age of 18 months to 24 months. What I saw yesterday indicates that he actually started to regress sooner than that. It's not uncommon sometimes when we're getting a history to, list something and then to go back and get further detail. So there's no doubt in my mind that based on the testimony that I heard yesterday, which was a little bit more detail that I was able to get than in the office, because frankly, in the office, we didn't really focus too much on the development. And I think I wrote something similar in my initial visit from September of 2002. So I would say that the most accurate picture of what happened to Yates is what I saw yesterday, corroborated by several family members.
When you try to determine the cause of a child's neurologic disorder, what do you do?
The neurological or autism or just neurological?
If you have a patient and you, for some reason, are trying to determine what caused the child's neurologic illness, what process do you go through in trying to
When I see a child for the first time that I want to evaluate neurologically, the first thing I do is to get a history, a good history, the best I can from the parents. That history taking can evolve over the course of several visits. So the history is very important because based on the history, I can have a sense as to what the diagnostic possibilities are. Then I do a general and neurological examination, mostly to test my internal hypothesis of the differential diagnosis that may be present. If I still don't have an answer, and if it's indicated, I will do certain testing. The evaluation that I do will depend on the symptoms, the presenting problems, and these may include neural imaging, electrodiagnostic testing such as EEGs, lab work, and so these are tests that we may do. I may have a particular presumptive diagnosis and may get another piece of information down the road that may alter or fine-tune my thinking and may cause me to refine my diagnosis. So that's the general approach that I take.
When did you first develop the opinion that Yates Hazelhurst, February 2001 MMR vaccination and the thimerosal-containing vaccines he received then and earlier in his life contributed substantially to his autism?
As I recall, with the first visit, I was struck by a few things, and I don't have that first visit in front of me, but I can basically remember that I was struck by the fact that he had regressive autism based on the history. I was struck by the gastrointestinal problems that he had had, and I was struck with his recurrent infections. And so basically, I looked at the possibility that the vaccines could have played a role. I did not necessarily make up my mind, and in fact, my approach was to try to rule everything out first and to use that as a diagnosis of exclusion, because there are other factors that can cause regression. For instance, if I have a 18-month-old in front of me who looks dazed, is not responding, that child may be having a type of seizure we call non-convulsant status epilepticus, and we see this from time to time. There are other metabolic conditions that can present superficially like autism. So even if I have a history that suggests a possible vaccine injury, I would first not just rely on the history, use that information, but try to rule out other factors first. And if I cannot come up with a better explanation, then is to do some testing or see what tests are done to support the notion that vaccines may play a role.
From the description you give us, I take it that you were aware of the proposition that MMR vaccines and thimerosal might cause autism before you saw it, Jake.
Yes, I was aware of that, yes.
So did you apply the process you described two questions ago when you tried to determine what was causing Yates' autism?
Yes, I did. We've done several tests, not only right after that visit, but with subsequent visits, just to try to get a sense of what might be present, what underlying problems might be present with Yates. I also encourage the parents to do everything they can in terms of other specialists, because I look at it as a team approach. No single physician has all the answers, and encourage them to keep me informed of some of the tests. And so I did a prolonged EEG, a 24-hour EEG, and several labs along the way to specifically try to find out what the underlying factors might be.
In your opinion, was the MMR vaccination that Yates Hazelhurst received on February 8, 2001, a substantial contributing factor to his regressive autism?
With all the evidence, both in Yates' case and also what I know in general based on studies, I would say that the MMR played a significant role. In the case of Yates, I could only reach that conclusion after several other tests have been ruled out. He's had very extensive genetic workup. He's had a karyotype high resolution where each chromosome was combed very carefully to see if he might have a specific genetic disorder, as various genetic disorders can cause autism. He's had what's called subtelomeric deletion testing. It's one thing to rule out chromosomal disorders, yet another thing to look with a fine comb if the ends of the chromosomes might have a little mutation. That's called subtelomeric deletion. He had fragile X, which is a fairly common, relatively speaking, genetic cause of autism. That was ruled out. He had methylation studies for Prader-Willi and Angelman syndrome, which is located on chromosome 15. That was ruled out. He's had a variety of metabolic testing, including amino acids. There's a condition called phenylketonuria, or PKU, which can, untreated, present as autism. That was checked, and in fact, all of the amino acids were normal, organic acids were normal, and a variety of metabolic testing. He's had an MRI of the brain that was also normal, ruling out a structural abnormality. There are some structural problems that could mimic autism. So all of these things having been ruled out, and he did go to Harvard, and he saw Dr. Tim Bowie, who did a scope. He also had a biopsy of the gut, which showed that he had colitis. He had also the finding of nodular hyperplasia, which has been described by various individuals, Wakefield, Ullman, and various others. And along with his profile of regression and also not only neurological deterioration but gastrointestinal problems following the vaccine, I must say that I cannot find any better explanation as a regular child neurologist seeing patients like Yates and others. I must conclude that played a significant role in Yates' case.
In your opinion, would Yates Hazelhurst have developed regressive autism if he had not received the MMR vaccination?
I really don't have any basis to say that he would not have, based on the evidence that I have at hand. You know, we see a child who's developing very well, who's, I think, was actually advanced in many ways, getting vaccinated, and then subsequently, a couple of months later, a slow regression into the world of autism. Because I don't have any better explanation with all of the labs that have been done, not just by me, but by two other neurologists. He saw Dr. Zimmerman at Johns Hopkins, and I think he saw another, I think, Guggenheim or someone else in Tennessee, and he's been seen by immunologists, he's been seen by Tim Bowie. So I could not find any alternative explanation for that. I just want to state that, you know, initially, if you have a child who regresses after vaccine, it could be coincidence. That's a possibility. Or the vaccine may play a role. And I think if you rule out all the other causes and if you have a good explanation that supports the persistence of measles virus in the gut and the brain, then it's a very fair assumption to say that plays a role. We do not have tissue biopsies that show the measles virus in Yates, although I think that was a goal to have that done, and I would welcome that if, you know, if that were made available. But knowing that children with, many children with lymphonodular hyperplasia who have gastrointestinal problems and autism, that it's been shown through several studies that infer that the measles virus is present, we can then infer that since he has the same findings, although we do not have the measles test done in Yates, that that's what is going on in this case.
When you introduced that answer, I'm sure, not sure you answered it in a way that I understood. I come to ask you, do you believe, I'm sure I think a better way to ask the question, but for the, do you think that Yates would have developed autism had he not received the MMR vaccine?
No, I don't think he would.
You mentioned some of the facts specific to Yates' regressive autism that made you think the vaccine contributed to his, was a substantial contributing factor in his disease. How important in your analysis was it that he was normal before the vaccination?
I think it's very important. In fact, I don't think I would have considered at all this possibility if he was in the other group of children who have problems since, say, early infancy. What made me even consider this possibility is that he fit a particular profile. It's my belief, having worked with hundreds of kids with autism, that we're not dealing with one disorder. Instead, we're dealing with a variety of subtypes of autism, and it's really a little bit problematic that we don't have any particular laboratory tests at this time today to diagnose autism. It's a clinical diagnosis. So we have to do our very best to categorize the subtypes. Yates fits very well in the subclass of children with autism who not only has regressive autism, but also has gastrointestinal problems, who has been sickly with recurrent infections. So that was the first step that led me to a consideration or inclusion in my differential diagnosis that that could be a problem.
In order to fit this profile, how soon should the child's first symptoms of autism begin?
As far as the what, regressive or the post-vaccination? Yep.
I didn't make that clear enough because I want to make it clear. You mentioned several times that Yates fits the profile that suggests the MMR vaccination contributed to his autism. And you said that regression after the MMR vaccination was a part of that. And I'm trying to ask you if there is a time period in which the regression after should occur after the MMR vaccination for a child to fit this profile.
Oh, I see, yes. My answer would be based on multiple other cases that have fit a similar profile, and also what I know about the natural course of a post-measles virus encephalitis. We know that with post-measles encephalitis, especially the subacute type, you can start having symptoms in the first month, or you may not have symptoms until 9 months later. There's the case I mentioned earlier. I think the author is Pittenham, who demonstrated a case of post-measles, post-MMR measles encephalitis that occurred about 8.5 months after the child was vaccinated with MMR. Based on all of that information, I would say that the range would be anywhere from 8 to 9 months based on the factors that I have mentioned. And I think it would, of course, vary with the individual based on what other factors might be present, as I think that the best way to look at these cases is to look at it in terms of contributing factors.
In your opinion, is the child's case stronger where the first symptoms of the autism are at a month or two than at 8 or 9 months?
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily because clinically, variation is the name of the game. Some things occur early, some things occur late. I think that one has to. I think if you're in that 1 to 9 months, that's pretty good. That's a good suggestion that you're dealing with a post-infectious problem or post-measles vaccine problem. But whether it occurs at 1 month or 3 months, I don't think that we have enough information to say that it's more likely at 1 month than 4 months, or at least I've not seen that in the literature.
In order to fit this profile, was it necessary that that Yates had gastrointestinal symptoms?
Yes, that's one of the other factors that I think from the very start caught my attention, is that Yates had a lot of gastrointestinal problems. The fact that he had gastrointestinal problems raises the issue of, could he be in the subset of children that have this so-called lymphonodular hyperplasia, colitis, or inflammation of the gut? And frankly, I was not surprised when the testing from Dr. Bowie showed that he did have colitis, he did have lymphonodular hyperplasia. And although the findings from Dr. Bowie were called mild, they weren't mild, they weren't so mild that he did not feel that medication was necessary. He placed them on medication and he started doing a lot better. So I think that the gastrointestinal symptoms, just based on what we know in the literature, based on studies that have made this association of autism, developmental delay, lymphonodular hyperplasia, that played a significant role in my diagnostic impression.
What kind of gastrointestinal symptoms would you need in order, should a child have, to fit this profile?
I would say you'd have to have a child who has diarrhea, who has constipation, but mostly the diarrhea. Child with reflux, possibly, though I would say diarrhea would be a bigger component. Having evidence of a malabsorption would be an even stronger case, because what the underlying pathology shows is basically a gut-related problem that's immunologically based. So there's something attacking the gut, causing swelling. That swelling can cause leakiness of the gut. That leakiness of the gut can cause certain nutrients that should properly be absorbed to get inside the bloodstream, hence can cause the multiple food allergies that we tend to find. In fact, Dr. Bowie's report mentioned that there was an eosinophilic component. I've spoken to several pediatric gastroenterologists to ask them, what is the significance of the eosinophilia in the gut? And they say that it is an indication of some type of allergic response. So I think all of these things are quite significant.
In your opinion, was the thimerosal that Yates Hazelhurst was exposed to through his vaccinations a substantial contributing factor in his regressive autism?
I think thimerosal played a role, but I don't think that it played a role that was as great as the MMR, and this is based on the following findings. If you look at his vaccines, he had DTAP, diphtheria, tetanus, acell, or pertussis, of the Infanrix type, which did not contain thimerosal. He did have hepatitis shots, which I think did contain the thimerosal. But I was able to find in his labs some indicators that the thimerosal played a role. And these indicators were his glutathione, which is an antioxidant, one of the most important antioxidants in the body. The glutathione is a ubiquitous molecule that counters free radicals throughout the body and the brain. And it's well known, very well known through the work of Dr. James and colleagues that, and various others, that children with autism have a very low, or have a lower glutathione compared to non-autistic individuals. If your glutathione is low, of course, that can contribute to your recurrent infections. His glutathione level was low, and of course, that can also lead to oxidative stress. The other finding in his labs is that he had significant elevation in one of his porphyrins. Porphyrin is a substance that is in our heme, which when synthesized becomes hemoglobin, and that heme is what gives the blood the redness of its color. Well, his cocal porphyrin, one of the porphyrins, urococal porphyrin 3, was significantly elevated. The problem is mercury has been shown through a study from France with Dr. Neita, and later replicated with a prospective study with Dr. Geyer, that the mercury can literally inhibit the synthesis of the porphyrins. With this inhibition of the synthesis, the porphyrins, some backup products, will rise in the body and will be excreted in the blood. You can check that in the blood. And so porphyrins are a good way to test for mercury toxicity, and this was elevated. So we do have some laboratory evidence that the thimerosal played a role in Yank's case. Although if I had to pick between MMR and thimerosal, I would say that the MMR had a larger contributing role.
Do you believe that the thimerosal's role was a substantial contributing factor to his autism?
Well, I think based on the lab tests that it did contribute significantly enough to cause impairment in his porphyrins, and also significantly enough to cause his glutathione level to be lower than normal.
Let me ask you a question about, you mentioned that you think that the MMR vaccine role was more significant. If the special master were to say, for one reason or another, not accept your testimony concerning the MMR vaccination, do you think the evidence concerning thimerosal is sufficient to stand by itself as a cause of his autism?
From what we know, again, with the various studies looking at thimerosal, we know that thimerosal is linked to autism. Through various studies, I point to studies from Dr. Holmes, Bradstreet, and others that show that children with autism have a bigger burden of mercury, not just exposure, but in terms of excretion. And so, based on the labs, if I did not have any labs, the answer would be no. But because we do have some labs, I think that that's sufficient. I did mention that the DTAP was not the type that contained mercury, but again, we can't just look at the amount. We can't look at the level of mercury. So, although I think that comparatively speaking, the mercury may have had a lower case, and I'm making that argument just based on all of the evidence that I have, I do think it's still significant, and that would have played a significant role.
If, on the other hand, the special master were to, for whatever reason, reject your testimony and the other evidence available that that thimerosal contributed to Yates-Hazelhurst's autism, are you of the opinion that the evidence concerning the relationship between the MMR vaccination and Yates's regressive autism is sufficient to stand on its own, if it were?
Yes, I think based on the testing that he had that demonstrated lymphonodular hyperplasia, colitis, his entire profile, and what I would call pertinent negatives, that is exclusion of other possible causes for his autism, I would say yes.
Do you hold the opinions that you've expressed today to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, the opinions expressed were correct based on my way of thinking.
That's all the questions I have.
Thank you. I have a few questions, Dr. Corbier. I wonder if counsel is interested in a brief break before we begin the class.
Actually, Special Master, if we could take maybe a half hour at this point, then I know we could probably finish up before lunch for the end of the day.
Okay. All right. I just have a couple of questions, Dr. Corbier, before we do this. You have referenced several times the profile. As I go forward, would you tell me, in your view, what is the profile that you believe Yates represents?
She represents the profile of a specific subset of children with autism who, number one, have regressive autism, so children who are developing normally and at a particular point start to regress. That's number one. Number two in the profile are children with regressive autism that, in addition, have significant gastrointestinal problems, so the chronic diarrhea, malabsorption problems. And included in that would be children who, along with the gastrointestinal problems, could be shown to have this nodular hyperplasia, which is a finding that Wakefield in England, I think now almost 10 years ago, reported, and others, all men, other people reported. So the lymphonodular hyperplasia in conjunction with the gastrointestinal problems. And then a third, which is not necessarily present in the profile, but often is immunological disturbances. I say immunological because children that have this profile of regression and gastrointestinal problem have gastrointestinal problems that have been linked to immunological deficits.
What immunological deficits would you be looking for that would fit this profile?
I think the best would be, for instance, finding autoantibodies. Autoantibodies are antibodies where the immune system secretes antibodies that, instead of being directed against viruses and bacteria, are directed against certain tissues, including brain cells. Yates did have an immunological workup that was normal, at least the things that were tested, but I didn't see any mention of testing for antibodies to the brain, for example, which would show a what we call spewing of Th1 to Th2, meaning going from a cellular immunity to one that's based on antibodies. So basically, these children may have a higher susceptibility to developing autoimmune problems.
So. Do you believe that what in this record supports your view about his immunological
disabilities? Yes. What makes me think that is that he was sickly. I believe that the infections that Yates had, his recurrent, not just viral infections, but also yeast infections, and this need for chronic antifungals. I feel that all of these things suggest that he was sickly and was not just the average intermittent infection type of child. He was a sickly child. So that suggests that his immune system was impaired. Now, a lot of people, when they talk of immunological disturbances, a lot of physicians think of immunodeficiency the same way you would think of AIDS or someone who's on chemotherapy. These people are severely depressed and show certain signs with their labs. However, someone who is sick all the time, you can infer that there's something wrong with their immune system. The immune system's impaired. The same way that I would say, Yates, his MRI of the brain was completely normal, but we know he has a neurological problem. He's lost the ability to speak the way he was talking before. He's not interacting well. So we know he has a brain problem, although I can't prove it with the MRI. So I think that the fact that he was sick all the time means, and even the lymphadenopathy that several members have pointed out. Lymphadenopathy is just swollen lymph nodes. That is usually a reactive sign that there's an infection going on. If the lymph nodes are swollen all the time or for a prolonged period of time, it means that the body is still reacting to viruses. In fact, that would actually make me think of a persistence of some type of virus. And of course, we talked about persistence of measles virus. If I may just elaborate a little bit further, when someone is normally vaccinated with the MMR, pediatricians tell parents that you may, after a few weeks, start experiencing some mild symptoms, rash, you might experience flu-like symptoms. When they say this, they're really saying that the measles virus may kick in a little bit, not too much. You don't want to actually create the illness, but just elicit an immune response that tells the body that the body will not have memory for the virus, and then the clinical symptoms go away. And then later on, maybe 2 months later, you may have a few other symptoms referable to the mumps and rubella, etc. But what happens if you have these symptoms in a persistent manner, chronic lymphadenopathy, chronic not feeling well for a variety of causes? The parents talked about feeling warm. You know, a lot of times pediatrician would ask for the actual temperature. You know, was there a thermometer that was used? So we don't know what the temperature was, but, you know, let's say Yates felt warm intermittently. I would say that may not necessarily be significant, you know. But if he feels warm all of the time, even in the absence of an actual measurement, although I couldn't prove it, but I would suspect that along with the chronic lymphadenitis and all of the other symptoms, that there was something going on with his immune system.
Do you think that if, in your opinion, absent his autism diagnosis, with the number of, he did have a number of ear infections and ultimately ended up with ear tubes, so there's evidence that he's reacting to something true. Absent a diagnosis of autism, would it strike you that the number of his ear infections and illnesses and that sort of thing, you still characterize this as someone who is sickly, out of the ordinary for small children?
Well, I see a lot of children with neurological problems that I can see a difference between some children that are occasionally sick and other children that are sickly, that is, they're sick all the time. You know, I refuse to believe that children that are as sick as Yates was just the norm. I do, however, accept the fact that it is normal, or it is acceptable, I should put it that way, to have a few infections when you're young, especially if you're exposed. But if you keep getting sick recurrently to the point of being on multiple, not just antibiotics, but multiple antifungals, then I must conclude that the immune system is impaired. Not necessarily immunodeficient. In most physicians' mind, when you say immunodeficient, you're thinking of severe abnormalities that you can document with labs, and like I say, conditions like HIV, chemotherapy, certain immunological disorders. But I'm arguing for an immunological impairment of some sort.
Let me ask as well. Dr. Bowie has submitted a letter and found colitis, an allergic colitis in Yates. Yates apparently does have some food allergies that have been established. With absent any findings, if there hasn't been a presence of MMR, that has been at least established by tests that has been found in Yates' gut. Do you think that it's sufficient for his food allergies to have established the colitis that was present for him? And if it were just attributable to food allergies, would that change your opinion about the MMR persistence?
If he did not have the clinical signs that I saw, the recurrent vomiting, or the recurrent, sorry, diarrhea, if it was just that, with none of the clinical symptoms, I would, yes, say that that's a possibility. I would say that the colitis, the allergy component, or the eosinophilic, could be due to food allergies. But putting it together with the clinical profile of recurrent diarrhea, in fact, if you look at his gastrointestinal symptoms, they almost seem out of proportion to the gut findings, which is not necessarily unusual with medicine. Sometimes you'll see a lot of clinical symptoms, and then you may not see a lot of, or a significant finding, or I shouldn't say significant, but a severe finding to match that. So I think in order to answer that question, I have to look at the context. If he did not have any bloating, any diarrhea, any protuberant belly, and just that, I would say, yes, there's a good possibility that the food allergy could be.
One more question. You referenced a patient of yours who developed tics following a vaccination that that were ameliorated or eliminated after we went to the emergency detoxification program. Did these behavioral problems improve?
Yes, yes, they did. In fact, if I may explain this a little bit further, there's been a lot of talk about chelating children with autism who are shown to have or who have evidence of mercury toxicity. As a neurologist, I was not trained to think of chelation that way. I had chelated kids who are in the ICU with lead toxicity who are in a coma, for example. I had chelated children like this, but that was the first case I saw of a child who was not that sick in terms of, you know, coma, seizures, but just developed significant tics post-vaccines. That was the very first time I chelated someone, because I tried to find evidence laboratory-wise that the child did have mercury post-chelation. I gave a small dose and was able to collect some mercury in the urine. And so I used that, if you will, as a test case. Which was very successful. Not only did the tics stop, but so did the ADHD symptoms and other conditions that the child had, which gave me the impetus to consider chelation in other patients, including with autism.
Was that the most pronounced behavioral
problem? By the attention, he was aggressive too. Intermittently, he was aggressive, but he was just very hyperactive, and the tics were interfering with his daily routine.
At what age do you think normal development needs to occur, and when there's a taper off, or it becomes regressive?
Regressive. Well, the regression in a general sense, in a neurological sense, the regression could occur almost at any age. For example, patients with Rett syndrome, which is another condition that presents with autistic features, the regression in that particular condition can start anywhere from 6 months to 18 months on average.
Yes. Absent any of those, just with the profile that you're talking about.
Oh, with my profile, yeah.
Your profile.
Yeah, what I have seen with others and with personal experience, I would say the regression is often seen somewhere between the 12-month to 24-month period. And I really can't pinpoint very specifically where, you know, in that group. But usually children that have regressive autism can regress typically between 12 months to a couple of years. But there are exceptions. There are some kids that do not regress until after 3 years of age.
Thank you. That would be great. We will recess till 10:50.